Okay, welcome back. And Tom shared one of the verses of America the Beautiful. And this is one we may not all be familiar with. America, America, God mends thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law.
We never do that.
So that makes it a true prayer. So take a look on page 41. I just wanted to mention one thing. Alice already pointed out something from this section, but I just want to point out that what we're doing here is trying to upgrade our religious approach. And we would also want to upgrade our sense of what patriotism is. We started doing this in the 60s when we took a stand against the Vietnam War. So on 41, first paragraph, our adult task is not only to form a mature religious consciousness, but to learn to have a grown-up patriotism. In medieval times, people were loyal to their lord in an unquestioning way. If that is how we are patriotic now, we have not grown up in that area. Adults can choose to be loyal, but not blindly obedient. They can declare that the emperor has no clothes when necessary. Healthy adult patriotism is fidelity to one's homeland, with keen interest in and questioning of its policies. And further, it is not tribal self-interest, America first, with a lack of concern for the welfare of other nations. The common good becomes the good of all humanity. And that certainly would reflect the Christian view. Okay, any questions on that or left over from before we go on? All right, let's take a look on 43. I want to point out that quote by Stephen Patterson from his book, The God of Jesus, which I read and do recommend. And you see the quotation at the beginning, that God's voice is the voice of some indistinct father, like Washington's portrait in my third grade classroom. His face appears wise and kind to those who acquiesce to the assumptions of our cultural canons. But to those who strain and pull against his spiritual grip, the furrows in his brow deepen into a stern warning not to go too far. So you want to ask yourself, is there anybody still in your life whose furrows you are obeying?
I want to comment on that. Recently it came to my attention that there are a lot of expressions that we hear not from the church, but from our parents as we're growing up.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my father used to say, live and let live, which I consider a positive message in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that there are expressions like this that you pick up and you kind of forget about. I started trying to remember them, and gradually I could remember more of them, and I have mentioned this to my friends, and their first reaction was, oh no, I can't remember a thing that my father, for example, ever said. And a week or two later, they said, you know, I was thinking about it, my father used to say such and such, I remember it now very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are strongly influenced by these messages.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And they stay inside. Mm-hmm. Because they were not simply data with information, they were programming. So many of our beliefs were programmed into us rather than just presented as information.
I don't remember the furrows But my father had a look. Remember a lot of expression. Yeah. He had a look that, my recollection is, was used in public rather than verbally telling my brother and I to straighten out. He didn't need words. So he took care of it all.
Yeah.
You can't be a father without the look.
So speaking of father, the word for father in Latin is pater, and the monotheistic religions, that is Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, are patriarchal, and so it's good for us to look at what are some of the features of a patriarchal religion that may have been programmed into us. And so if you look over on 44, of course it's going to be about control. And so your personal experience can't be trusted. And this would be particularly true of females. Very suspicious of intuitions. In fact, I say there, the feminine is distrusted and no females can be in power. Mm-hmm. That would be true in all three of those religions. Only those duly authorized can be trusted to hold and preach the truth, not necessarily those with mature intuition or sensitive conscience. The granting of grace is limited to rituals that require authorized male dispensers. You can't get the grace if a woman is presiding. Revelation is from above and can't be added to once the authorities have decided on what is to be included in the official canon. The authorities have the right and power to include or exclude, to decide who is in and who is out, who is the true believer and who is not. That's why excommunication is one of their main sanctions. A facilitating religion, or one that helps us be more human, communicates. A dominating religion excommunicates. Order is maintained by threat, coercion, punishment, and reward, rather than being invitational. Input from the laity or ordinary people is not required in making major church decisions. A good old boy cronyism network of loyalty allows for cover-ups and mutual protection. Of course, we've seen that recently. A double standard for males and females obtains, especially regarding decisions about one's body. Mm-hmm. More rules about women's bodies than men's. Heterosexual marriage for procreation is the only legitimate avenue to sexual experience. They definitely want to be in control of that. Power is legitimized by reason of succession from the original authorities who have passed on the keys of the kingdom. The patriarchal God is on a throne in heaven at a far remove from us, like the authorities. They're usually at a distance and safely tucked away. There is a suspicion about nature, mysticism, and of the immanent God, the God within, none of which can be controlled. So that's why it's suspected. The preservation of the institution and the authority of its hierarchy is the ultimate and unalterable goal of religion. Religion works hand in glove with state authority and makes unquestioning patriotism a virtue. Hand in glove with the war-making state. Authorities pay no attention to low or mid-level workers nor do they express appreciation to them, but focus fiercely on them if they create notoriety. And authorities are above the law. That's the arrogance of power. And all of these, of course, were meant or said to be there so they can protect us. So now we want to be really suspicious about a religion that comes to us in this style, the patriarchy, because it is not in the best interest of our becoming full human beings with access to all our powers. Does this make sense to everybody?
David?
Yes.
Why do you think the emphasis has been so much on sexual issues in all three religions?
Yeah.
Why is it that sexuality is such a damning feature to them?
Because it's bad.
So why do they do that?
I think it's because it's one way we have of expressing our own power, of being in our full passions and our full expression. And it's something that can go out of control easily. And so they're afraid of any part of us that might get away from them.
Well, it's creative, so there's no predicting what.
There's no predicting, right. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's so dangerous.
I think another factor is that for men, they can get away with doing it, so you have to put more controls on it. Women don't get away with
That's right.
When God created man, she was only joking.
I was an excommunicated Catholic for 12 years, and I don't have an excommunicated forehead or anything, but because I married a priest. And it was amazing, we got 13 years after we were married? I guess it was 13, well, here. 13 years after we were married, we got given our
reinstated.
Whatever that means. And they wanted to get married in the church. And to me, it has always been so ridiculous because God is so much bigger than all that. And people would say, "Well, now you can receive the sacraments." I'm like, are you kidding? You know, it feels like all this power is really only your interpretation of power. Mm-hmm. I'm the one in charge. You know, it's not. People say, well, and it has to do with sexuality, too.
It's
bad, you know. But I know how it feels to be
excommunicated,
but you have to rise above it and say,
I don't think God's in power, I think we are.
That's right,
Mark. That's right. Power. I mean, I made that decision, not God or the church.
Yeah.
But we give so much power to these. You know, you don't have to give it away. That's
no. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's subjective.
Yeah.
They only have the power to the extent that we give it to them. But remember that it was programmed into us, so it will always be hard to let go of fully. Mm-hmm. And it will still mean a lot and feel terrible to be excommunicated.
What that means, in a sense, is the church has put itself in the place of God.
Oh, in many ways, yes.
And so we think the church speaks, God is speaking. Well,
yeah.
I'm afraid that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Keith?
Nancy and I got the laicization after we were married. And the priest who was reading the stuff said, "No, you're no longer excommunicated." And Nancy says, "What do you mean? He's excommunicated, I wasn't." He said, "Oh yes, you were." Nancy says, "I was not." And I said, "You were." So there.
Okay. I gave my little example on the bottom of 47, which I really enjoy. So let's take a quick look at it, because it kind of winds up this topic. Page 47, paragraph at the bottom. In the ancient Greek city of Dodona, the people revered an old oak tree because they noticed it had oracular qualities. In other words, you lie under the tree in a meditative state, and you present your question, and you feel as if some intuitive answer is coming through. This is what was going on. As news of this miraculous tree spread, priests confirmed its powers and proclaimed them to be from Zeus, the king of the gods. Soon after, the tree was set apart as sacred and became off limits to ordinary people. Now they had to make their requests to the oracle through the intermediary priests, who required offerings.
Yes.
This is a metaphor for how the patriarchy in a dominating religion can appropriate the spiritual realizations of the people. What began in Dodona as an encounter with nature and a folk faith in the transcendent fell into the hands of the official priesthood. Male functionaries became the necessary mediators who decided how the graces were to be dispensed. But for adults, the sacred oak needs no guardian authority to preserve it. The it is, after all, the inner life of nature, ever open to and reflective of the powers in every human psyche. Mm-hmm. See if we could only take back our power in that way. Yeah. Because, of course, the tree represents the inner oracular wisdom that's in all of us. Okay, so let's take a quick look into our next chapter. And I talk about it on 54 that, first of all, let's remind ourselves that the four basic elements of religion, belief, moral code, rituals, and devotion, are also in spirituality. The main difference is that religion is usually institutionalized and spirituality is personal. So you decide on your own rituals and your own beliefs. That's the main difference. But further than that, spirituality for some people can mean sentiments or the espousal of New Age beliefs that can be superstition. People may still call themselves spiritual while they have a self-serving moral sense, engage in comforting but not consciousness-impelling rituals, express devotion to religious figures without imitating their virtues. And it's all about me rather than we. But if spirituality is to have meaning, it has to reflect the culture and needs of its time. Today we have global consciousness, so we need a spirituality that focuses on co-creating the planet, growing in social consciousness, and being passionately concerned about justice, peace, and love, reaching fully into every corner of life. Spirituality is not only personal, but cosmic. And we know that this cosmic consciousness has happened to us when our love reaches beyond our near and dear, to all humanity far and wide. Our insight is no longer limited to what we gain from personal experience, but accesses perennial wisdom. And we're committed not only to healing ourselves, but to everyone, especially in the realm of reconciliation and universal human rights. So this would be the way that spirituality grows up. It moves from an egoic style where it's all about me to a spiritual awareness. this make sense to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at that quotation on the top of 57. This is from John Woolman in his Quaker Diary. He was an English 18th century Quaker who spent his life in a campaign against slavery. Here we have a prospect of one common interest from which our own is inseparable, so that we turn all that we possess into the channel of universal love, and that becomes the business of our lives. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody who really got it. Oh, so this is what it's about. Take everything that you say, feel, and do, and put it into a channel of universal love. That's what we're here for. Imagine having that kind of grace that you could see that and then even act on it.
That's what your prayer is.
Yeah, and the prayer about love is certainly about that. Yeah.
Was he, if I'm not mistaken, was he he was sort of an itinerant preacher?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the same person.
Yes.
He didn't have one community, which was very, very against the norm for the Quakers.
Mm-hmm. Now take a look at the bottom of 61, because I want to go back to one point in Buddhism that someone brought up. Someone brought up the idea of, you know, integrating the two. Sometimes what I found in Buddhism is a over-the-top style of love, wisdom, and healing. And every time I see that, I really try to stay with it and appreciate it and make it part of my life. So on the bottom of 61, look at that last paragraph. A spiritual religion provides a motivation for goodness, something that the science of psychology cannot do. Such a religion gives a vocabulary and skill set for the deepest yearnings in the psyche, something philosophy can't do. As an example, here are two of Buddhist Jizo Bodhisattva's vows flowing from a spiritual motivation. This character, a bodhisattva, is an enlightened person who rejects nirvana. He will not go into the full reward of nirvana. Nirvana is the extinguishing of fear and desire and the end of continual reincarnation. He will not go there until all the other humans can come in with him. Imagine having that consciousness. Psychology helps us become healthier as individuals, but not get us to this heroic level. And this is now the bodhisattva speaking. Only after all beings are taken across to enlightenment will I myself realize it. Only after all the hells are empty am I willing to become enlightened. Did the religion and spirituality of my childhood so inculcate love in me that I was drawn to make vows like that? Or was it about how to save myself? Imagine if that's what we had been taught. Yes, we want to be saved, but we're going to wait until everybody else can come in with us.
That's like at the Special Olympics when they get to the end of the line, get near the finish line, and somebody behind them trips and they go back.
Good. Yeah.
Yes, what a good example.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to say before we got off the topic, there are orders in the church. We have different orders that kind of help us see it in a different way of looking at life, I think. And then also we have retreat centers. Those are the good side, I think, that we have to look at.
Oh, we have goodness everywhere.
Well, I mean, some churches have it, too.
Yes. In every, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, none of this would be about canceling out all the wonderful things that we've gained from our experience. But what we're trying to do is appreciate all that and move it further and further into our cosmic, evolutionary, over-the-top style of caring about the world, so that it all becomes something that helps us be bigger. Okay, other questions about any of this? Yeah.
I think that what you're talking about requires really leaving your comfort zone and making a conscious decision to move some places where you no longer feel secure. You feel vulnerable. I one time received a pamphlet about a Christian program up in Oregon that was like 2 weeks either in India or a Central American country, and there were a lot of warnings in there saying you're not going as a tourist, and you're going to discover you're going to be in an area that is totally unfamiliar with you. The rules are entirely different. You're going to try every strategy that's ever worked for you in your life, and none of those strategies are going to be effective. We don't know what's going to happen to you as a result of this experience, but we do know that when you come back, you'll never be the same again. And in each case, it's putting you in a position of working with others, serving others, helping with others, but not in a place where you are a tourist taking pictures and coming home with an album to show your friends.
Mm. So it's more like a pilgrimage,
yeah,
of grace.
I have a comment too.
Yes.
It seems to me that when you talked about, you know, imagine if we'd been brought up with this. Well, this is almost too grown up for a child, a lot of it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the college kids that I was involved in Newman work for a lot of time. And the kids that came after our generation seemed to really miss the structure that they could mm-hmm. find an identity in,
mm-hmm.
because they grew up after Vatican II and all the strict structure that my generation grew up with had disappeared, and there was too much vagueness in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the main problem we've had as a church is not, we tend to stop the process of growing once they've made First Communion
mm-hmm.
or Confirmation mm-hmm. instead of continuing on with a ever more adult, ever more expansive view of our faith.
Yes.
That's which hard would be for institutions to do.
Very, yeah, because that would mean being ever more liberated and freer to see things in your own way, for mm-hmm. instance.
Yeah.
And work with the way you see something rather than be told, here are the proper beliefs to follow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that might work for a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a six-year-old can't take in too much nuance and complexity.
Right.
So you have to grow with it.
And we weren't prepared in the seminary for we weren't prepared for, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, Keith,
mm-hmm.
To help people grow toward adulthood.
Yeah.
It's more about here are the teachings and this is how you present
yeah.
it.
I have the answer.
We have, now you have the answers, you can tell the lay people.
Well, my experience at seminary was still too much, we have the answers, and you seminarians are going to learn it so you could pass it on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The seminarians weren't treated as adults.
No, we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. Jim?
You know, throughout history, dictatorships have been a necessary and better choice for uneducated populations. And this was true about the church. The church had to put out proclamations and rigid rules and so on so that people could follow them because they didn't have the education to go beyond that. And that was a mistake that we made in Vietnam and perhaps in Afghanistan. our culture and our type of democratic government may not be appropriate for uneducated populations. So in the Middle Ages, you know, there are all these kings and so on, they're dictatorships. The Catholic Church is a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think what where they lose out is that they think we're all simpletons like we were when we were 7 years old and got our first communion. And I just can't understand, well, I can understand because they feel threatened by a sense of independent thinking, but the church is not, the Catholic Church, is not meeting our needs anymore when we're 60 and 70.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's still the medieval church that it was in the 1600s, mm-hmm. and they're not meeting our needs for growth.
But there are pockets, there are places within the church where there is this new approach, including right here.
And this is not sponsored by the church.
No, that's true.
They are kind of bothered by
But as someone said, there are retreat places and there are, you know, many new possibilities in the church now. So they're not giving up. Alice?
One of the problems, I think, especially with young people today, are how we could get across this something new for them. Is that the perpetuation in the church of the separation between the sacred and the profane. So anything that happens in church or with the hierarchy, this is what the definition of holy is. And they never encouraged us to take that sacramental holiness into the domestic church, which was our home. So we were never encouraged to put a holy water font inside the door of our house and bless ourselves because we're entering sacred ground, and to treat it like we would a church and speak to one another there. Or every meal we eat is the Eucharist, and every time we forgive within the family, it's a sacrament. And so we've perpetuated this division. So we don't treat in our homes and with our children because they don't grow up with the sense that this is sacred holy space that's reserved for Sunday Mass, and as soon as we come out, then whatever we were taught there doesn't apply. So this idea of the sacramentality of all of life moving to every ritual being holy, everything we do being holy and attending to it, I think the young people today, that's what's needed, and that they are holy, mm-hmm. and they have a place in it, you know. But this perpetuation is, this is the holy in church. So you have to be married in a church. You can't be married in nature. You know, I mean, mm-hmm.
yes,
that's a great disservice and problem that we face.
Another dualism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Good point. Jane?
I think in support of what this gentleman was saying, I heard among thinking people that what the question was raised, what were the two most significant things that impacted the Catholics in this country in the last century? Well, there was easy consensus around, well, Vatican II, kind of a wake-up call. But the second one that was offered, interestingly, was the GI Bill of Rights. And that was the first opportunity, masses of Catholics had the opportunity for higher education, which contributed to the reality of a thinking.
Yes, thinking population, right? Good.
Yeah. I had a whole mass at my house, and after it was over, this woman who I just love her sense of humor, she says, "Now this is a church, and if you want to swear, you're going to have to go outside."
Yeah.
I think we also make a tremendous mistake when we don't treat all of nature and all of the universe as a sacred.
Yes.
That's one of the Buddhist things.
Very
everything is sacred.
Yeah.
Everything, well, not even sacred, everything is a part of one another.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't about sacredness, it's about interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yes.
Spirituality.
No separation. Yes. Yeah. Sue?
I want to make a comment. Christ is the King, Episcopal Church, sends their young adults to Israel on a pilgrimage, or a young journey to adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the privilege last year of listening to the report from the three boys that went. This year there's five girls that are going. And what their opinions were of all the women and being there. And it was very enlightening. And I'm very proud of it.
Mm, great. Yeah, so we see it happening everywhere.
I just wanted to bring up something that Anne made come to my mind. This is First Communion time. This is May. All the kids are receiving their First Communion. And they are getting the information that Christ does love them, God loves them. But they're also getting still the information that he died for their sins. And that there must be a more adult way of saying that. But a child is, I interpret it, he died for because I did something.
Yeah, yeah, which is not what it's about.
And that's not what it's about, but
it's
to be, you have to treat that very carefully.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad we can all share at this level. So our time is almost up, and I do want to end with a poem, but also remind you that for next time, we're going on to read chapters 4 and 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so please make note of some of your reflections after you read these two chapters, both on faith. What is faith and practicing adult faith? And we'll begin with checking in with you about your reflections, which are equally important to what's in the book. And also I want to mention when Alice brought up about sacred space, that in San Francisco, where I live half a year, I'm part of the what's called the Night Ministry.
Mm.
And one of the things that we do is we have a what's called a street cathedral. So we have Mass every Sunday, 5:30, in front of the library, outdoors, on the sidewalk. Mm. You know, so anybody can join in, and we take turns celebrating. And on Ash Wednesday and Blessing of the Throats, we stand right outside the entrance to the subway. So when people are coming and going, they can receive the ashes or receive the blessing. And this is a way of bringing the church to the people. And, you know, putting it right on the street instead of, that you have to go into the church to get the blessing. Does this make sense to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Good. So that means a lot. And so we see changes like that happen. And when I was standing out there on February 3rd, the Feast of St. Blaise, which in our tradition is, since he's the patron of the throats, we have a blessing on that day. And standing out there at the entrance to the subway, and you can imagine the kind of people walking by in the middle of San Francisco. And the other priest was Lutheran. So I'm there, and he's next to me, and he's Lutheran, and I'm Catholic, and, you know, we're both giving the blessing. And I thought, gee, how far we've come that, you know, we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of him as, you know, equally able to give the blessing as I am, even though I'm from the true church. we're no longer caught in that division.
And no one tried to arrest you or anything?
No.
Mary.
When you distribute the ashes, what do you say?
We use the traditional remember you, that you, we don't say man, it used to be man, remember man that thou art dust. So we say remember man or woman, that you are dust and unto dust you shall return. People seem to love getting the ashes for some reason. But that is, why is there a new?
No, I'm just wondering if...
Well, they don't say that one anymore?
It's a leading to a thought that we are sinners. Is that
It's more of a reminder of your impermanence with the dust idea. But what is the new?
Repent and believe.
Oh, now they have more than one to pick from.
Repent.
Do you know?
He has a good one. Catholic priest I know chooses to say, "Remember, you are stardust, and under the stars you will return."
All right. Well, I like the one about stardust. Well, I'd like to end with this beautiful sonnet by Gerard Manley Hopkins. He's a Jesuit poet, and you'll see the relevance of it. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like the shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why then do men not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is bleared with trade, seared with toil, and wears man's smudge, and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. But for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the brown west went, ah, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, ah, bright wings. Thank you all.